Palestine is the moral issue of our time. Our guests today are Chris Hedges and Gabor Mate. Chris Hedges is an award-winning independent journalist. He's the host of the Chris Hedges Report and the author of many books. His latest is A Genocide Foretold. Gabor Mate, a Holocaust survivor, is a Hungarian-born Canadian physician with a special interest in childhood development and trauma. They spoke at the Society of Ethical Culture in New York in May 2025. We begin with Gabor Mate.
I make my living really speaking the truth as I see it about human development, about trauma, about childhood, about illness, about health, what it means to be a human being. And I'm usually very confident and comfortable that I can convey in my words my understanding and perceptions of the world. In this case, I feel completely inadequate to actually put into words what I feel, what I see, and also what I perceive many human beings are going through right now. Simply, the words escape us. When in my adolescence, I first found out about the Nazi genocide of my own people, literally, almost every day when I would think about it, my head would spin. Literally, my head would spin. I think, how is this even possible? And I feel like I'm back with that adolescent, almost naive incomprehension about how this, what we're witnessing, can possibly be going on. Every era seems to have its moral touch point, and the theme tonight is Gaza as the moral issue of our time. In the 19th century, there was the question of freedom in Poland, actually. In the 20th century, amongst other major events, you might say that the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s was a moral touchstone. Where you stood on that issue told you where you stood about on the world. In the 1960s, 70s, it was the Vietnam War. But all those situations, as much as they concentrated the issue of human morality and human ethics, there was something somewhat different about them, in that at least in the Spanish Civil War and certainly in the Vietnam War, there was a fighting chance. And now we're seeing the slaughter of civilians and children and kids being amputated without anesthetics and being starved. And the press has always lied, but the lies have never been more egregious, and the silence has never been more deafening than it is today. And since I can't quite find the words, let me quote a Muslim, an Arabic writer, Omar al-Akkad, who in his wonderful, wonderful book, One Day Everyone Will Have Been Against This, says the following: the moral component of history, the most necessary component, is simply a single question asked over and over again. When it mattered, who sided with justice and who sided with power? What makes moments such as this one so dangerous, so clarifying, is that one way or another, everyone is forced to answer. And Palestine is the issue of our time, where you stand on that issue tells you whether you've got a heart that's even open and functioning. Because you see, in the Western world, we value knowing with the mind, with the intellect. And with the intellect, you can make all kinds of arguments about who started what and who's responsible for what. But to be even asking as to where the truth lies means that you're completely cut off from your heart and from your guts. So there's ways of knowing that combine the gut and the heart and the mind. And as somebody said, without the gut and the heart informing the mind, we're nothing but genius level reptiles. And those genius level reptiles are running our world right now. wonderful Palestinian writer, Muhammad al-Kurd, puts it this way: a universality that recognizes the Palestinian condition is the human condition. Palestine is a microcosm of the world, wretched, raging, fraught, and fragmented, on fire, stubborn, ineligible, dignified. The lens we lend the Palestinian reveals how we see each other and how we see everything else. And that is why Palestine is the moral issue of the world. And sometimes you wonder, what the hell world am I living in? Last year, when there were pictures of skeletal children, infants, in Gaza, you know what the New York Times had an article about in their Sunday front section? About a farm in Israel where they grew caviar for export, and how dedicated these workers were to still go to work despite the war, to grow the caviar, to export to Europe. And meanwhile, Palestinian kids were starving that the Times never mentioned. What world, I said to myself, are we possibly living in? Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper that not infrequently tells the truth, or some of the truth at least, calls the current situation a war of the generals against the children. And in Haaretz, there was an incredible article by Gideon Levy, you know, the Jewish organizations, the Holocaust Memorial industry. They recognize what they call righteous Gentiles. These are non-Jews that helped Jews during the horror of the Second World War. Well, one day, if they ever recognize righteous Jews, Gideon Levy will surely have pride of place. And in a recent article, I can't even know how to tell you this, he describes a visit by an Israeli TV presenter and influencer, a fashion influencer, who, protected by the Israeli army that she's completely in love with, visits this Palestinian village in the West Bank. And she reports, I had such admiration for these soldiers who had to put up with screaming grandmothers and screaming babies whose homes they had to enter at night, and they could still hold on to their humanity. Who makes up this stuff? I mean, you think you're living in La La Land, but it's serious. And this is what our press and our politicians and our culture shows to us all the time. Now here's what Omar al-Akkad writes about our civilization. And I'm quoting these people extensively because really I don't have the words. But thank God they do. And Omar writes, to preserve the values of the civilized world, it is necessary to set fire to a library, to blow up a mosque, to incinerate olive trees, to dress up in the lingerie of women who fled and then take pictures, to level universities, to loot jewelry, art, banks, food, to arrest children for picking vegetables, to shoot children for throwing stones, to parade the captured in their underwear, to bake a man's teeth and shove a toilet brush in his mouth, to let combat dogs loose on a man with Down syndrome and then leave him to die. Otherwise, the uncivilized world might win. And that's the world we're living in. And the Passover recently, the Jewish holiday, the New York Times writes about what? The missing person at the Seder table, at the Passover table. And who's that? is the Israeli hostage in captivity in Gaza. Not missing from anybody's table are the thousands of Palestinians, including multiple hundreds of children, who have been for decades kept in Israeli jails and tortured. Children tortured. They recently released a man who was 13 when he was arrested with no weapons. No weapons, and he was charged with attempted murder. He got 10 years. Now he's 10 years later, they released him, mentally ill, a broken person. Those people are never mentioned. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I was in the West Bank working with Palestinian women who'd been tortured in Israeli jails. And let me tell you, they got to hand it to the Israelis. They really know how to torture people. They've developed certain skills. That's one of them. And this has, of course, been documented by Israeli Physicians for Human Rights, all kinds of Israeli witnesses, international organizations, never talked about in the Western press. The fact that the head of the orthopedic surgery at Al-Shifa Hospital was a perfectly healthy, vigorous, 50-year-old man, was captured, and 6 weeks later, he died without his underclothes on, with blood streaming from his rectum, with his ribs broken, never reported in the North American press. It's just beneath our attention. Well, what does that tell us about Palestine as the moral issue of our time? The Dutch-American writer Jacob Riis, who wrote this book on the tenements of Newark, in fact, it was a bestseller back in the 1890s. He said, "The world forgets too easily what it does not like to remember." And that forgetting is instantaneous. And you know, I don't know how this is going to end. All I know is that all the speaking that Chris has done, all the wonderful people that he's interviewed, all the interviews that I've been invited to speak on, the millions of people that have seen us and other people speak online, has not saved a single finger of a single Palestinian child. It does mean that we have to hold on to a sense of morality and possibility that goes beyond the present moment. Well, let me tell you one more thing. I recently wrote the foreword to a book by a Palestinian psychiatrist. Her name is Dr. Salma Jabbar. She was head of mental health for Palestine. But she was too honest and too sharp in her criticism of the traitorous Palestinian Authority. So she no longer has that position. But in her book, you know what she writes? She writes, "How do I deal with the suicidal depression of an 82-year-old man who came to me for help when the house that he built with his own hands, now 20 years later, he's being forced to dismantle with his own hands? Do I give him Prozac for his depression?" I have no idea what the answer that history will finally declare on current events. What I do know is that, well, there was this Jewish sage 100 years before Jesus. His name was Hillel. And he said that the task is not yours to finish, the task of healing the world, but neither are you free not to take part in it. And I think that's a choice we can all make in the present moment. We don't know how it's going to end, and none of us, I hope it's otherwise, but none of us in our lifetimes may see justice the way we'd like to see it, but by God, we can make a contribution, however big, however little that is, and we can make sure that Palestine is never, ever, ever forgotten. Thank you.
My old office in Gaza is a pile of rubble. The streets around it, where I went for coffee, ordered maftoul or manakish, had a haircut, are flattened. Friends and colleagues are dead, or more often have vanished. Last heard from weeks or months ago, no doubt buried somewhere under the broken slabs of concrete. The uncounted dead in the tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands. Israel has made Gaza a wasteland, 50 million tons of rubble and debris. Rats and dogs scavenge amid the ruins and the fetid pools of raw sewage, the putrid stench and contamination of decaying corpses rises from beneath the mountains of shattered concrete. Palestinians, 90% of whom are displaced, risk death from unexploded ordnance left behind after 18 months of airstrikes, artillery barrages, missile strikes, and blasts from tank shells, and a variety of toxic substances, including raw sewage and asbestos. Israel, supplied with billions of dollars of weapons from the United States, Germany, Italy, and the UK, created this hell, and it intends to maintain it. The blockade has resulted in outbreaks of hepatitis A caused by drinking contaminated water, ailments such as scabies, malnutrition. 60,000 children show signs of malnutrition. 57 Palestinians have starved so far since March 2nd, most of them elderly and children. Starvation, widespread nausea, and vomiting. Palestinians in Gaza live in makeshift tents encamped amid these slabs of concrete. Many have been forced to move over a dozen times. 9 in 10 homes have been destroyed or damaged. Apartment blocks, schools, hospitals, bakeries, mosques, universities. Israel blew up Isra University in Gaza City and the Turkish Palestinian Hospital, controlled demolitions. Cemeteries, shops, offices, all have been obliterated. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, estimates that clearing Gaza of the rubble will take 15 years and cost between $40 billion and $50 billion. But any rebuilding of Gaza, Israel and the Trump administration have decided, will not be done for the Palestinians. And Israeli organizations, including the far-right Nakala organization, have held conferences to prepare for Jewish colonization of Gaza once Palestinians are removed. This is the last chapter of the genocide, accentuated by the decision by Israel's security cabinet to occupy all of Gaza and remain there indefinitely while emptying the northern part of the Gaza Strip completely of Palestinians. It is the final blood-soaked push to drive the Palestinians from Gaza. No food, no medicine, no shelter, no clean water, no electricity. Israel has turned Gaza into a Dante-esque cauldron of human misery, where Palestinians are being killed in their hundreds and soon again in their thousands and tens of thousands, or they will be forced out, never to return. This final chapter marks the end of Israeli lies, the lie of the two-state solution, the lie that Israel respects the laws of war that protect civilians, the lie that Israel bombs hospitals and schools only because they are used as staging areas by Hamas, the lie that Hamas uses civilians as human shields, while Israel routinely forces Palestinians captive Palestinians to enter potentially booby-trapped tunnels and buildings ahead of Israeli troops. The lie that Hamas or Palestine Islamic Jihad are responsible, the charge often being errant Palestinian rockets, for the destruction of hospitals, United Nations buildings, or mass Palestinian casualties. The lie that humanitarian aid to Gaza is blocked because Hamas is hijacking the trucks or smuggling weapons and war material. The lie that Israeli babies are beheaded or Palestinians carried out mass rape of Israeli women. The lie that 75% of the tens of thousands killed in Gaza were Hamas, quote-unquote, terrorists. The lie that Hamas, because it was allegedly rearming and recruiting new fighters, is responsible for the breakdown of the ceasefire on March 18th, a breakdown that has seen more than 2,300 Palestinians killed, 6,000 injured, adding to the official death toll of 52,000, with, of course, thousands, perhaps tens of thousands more under the rubble. Israel's naked genocidal project is exposed. Nothing, if Israel has its way, will function. Bakeries, water treatment, sewage plants, hospitals, distribution centers, clinics. Less than half of the 53 emergency vehicles operated by the Palestine Red Crescent Society are functional because of fuel shortages, and soon there will be none. Israel's message is unequivocal. Gaza will be uninhabitable. Leave or die. And the images from Gaza during the past 18 months were awful. But what is coming now will be worse. It will rival the most atrocious war crimes of the 20th century, including the mass starvation, wholesale slaughter, and leveling of the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943 by the Nazis. October 7th marked the dividing line between an Israeli policy that advocated the brutalization and subjugation of the Palestinians and a policy that calls for their extermination and removal from historic Palestine. What we are witnessing is the equivalent of the moment triggered by the annihilation of some 200 soldiers led by George Armstrong Custer in June 1876 at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. After that humiliating defeat, Native Americans were targeted for extermination with the remnants forced into prisoner of war camps, later renamed reservations, where thousands died of disease, lived under the merciless gaze of their armed occupiers, and fell into a life of immiseration and despair. Expect the same for the Palestinians in Gaza, dumped, I fear, in one of the world's hellholes and forgotten. The expansion of Greater Israel, which includes the seizing of Syrian territory in the Golan Heights, southern Lebanon, Gaza, of course, and the occupied West Bank, where some 40,000 Palestinians have been driven from their homes, and which I expect will soon be annexed by Israel, is being cemented into place. But the genocide in Gaza is only the start. The world is breaking down under the onslaught of the climate crisis, which is triggering mass migrations, failed states, catastrophic wildfires, hurricanes, storms, flooding, and droughts. As global stability unravels, industrial violence, which is decimating the Palestinians, will become ubiquitous. Israel's annihilation of Gaza marks the death of a global order guided by internationally agreed upon laws and rules, ones often violated by the United States in its imperial wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but the one that was at least acknowledged as a utopian vision. The United States and its Western allies not only supply the weaponry to sustain the genocide, but obstruct the demand by most nations for adherence to humanitarian law. They have carried out attacks against the only nation, Yemen, which has tried to halt the genocide. The militarized drones, helicopter gunships, walls and barriers, checkpoints, coils of concertina wire, watchtowers, detention centers, deportations, brutality, and torture, denial of entry visas, apartheid existence that comes with being undocumented, loss of individual rights, and electronic surveillance are as familiar to the desperate migrants along the Mexican border or attempting to enter Europe as they are to the Palestinians. And the message the global North has given to the rest of the world is this: we have everything, and if you try and take it away from us, we will kill you. Thank you.
You're listening to Chris Hedges and Gabor Mate, Palestine, the Moral Issue of Our Time. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. We continue now with Chris Hedges.
I want to start by asking you about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Almost every university had Holocaust studies.
Yeah.
Theodor Adorno said that the whole purpose of an education was to prevent another Auschwitz. And yet with all of these studies, in the midst of this genocide, none of it seems to have penetrated within the society itself. And I'm wondering why, and then I want to ask you, how does one teach morality, and even if morality can be taught?
Yeah. Well, the first thing to notice, and again, this is nothing you'll ever see mentioned in the Western press, that there are at least six Israeli Jewish internationally renowned scholars of genocide and the Holocaust, former members of the Israeli Defense Forces, academics who have called the current situation in Gaza genocide. These are Jewish scholars. You never hear them quoted. What you always hear quoted is, it's a blood libel to even make the comparison. That's the first thing. The second thing is, as Norman Finkelstein has pointed out so beautifully, much of the intention of the Holocaust academia has got nothing to do with trying to change the world's relationship to cruelty and unfairness. It's to establish a sense of Jewish exceptionalism so that we're the perpetual victims and that everything we do is justified, everything that's done to us is an outrage. A case example is Germany, where Germany is often lauded as the country which has taken responsibility for its actions. Unlike, say, Japan, which has failed to acknowledge that it prostituted Korean women in the service of the Japanese forces in Korea and China. Well, that's true. Germany has pleaded mea culpa. But what have they learned? Nothing. It's in Germany that it's least dangerous for a Jew to speak about Palestine. Jews are arrested in Germany for calling for justice for the Palestinians. So teaching about the Holocaust teaches nobody anything. And the point is twofold. One is, you cannot teach morality. Morality is a natural human attribute that arises when people's human needs as children are met. Number one. Number two, you can preach about morality in the service of the most nefarious causes. And that's what we're seeing right now. I'm sure you've heard this statement before, the Hebrew word for the Holocaust is Shoah, and there's an old saying, there's no business like Shoah business. It's been exploited to the hilt, and you know, I'm somebody whose grandparents died in Auschwitz, who nearly ended up there myself, and I'm sick of it. I'm sick of hearing about it. Not because it's not didn't happen, but because what it has been pressed into the service of. Now, I'd like to ask you a question. You mentioned the Warsaw Ghetto, and one of the leaders of the Warsaw Ghetto, Marek Edelman, who survived the war and became a cardiac surgeon or cardiologist and a real fighter for liberty, supported the Solidarity Labor Movement, always stood for Palestinian rights. Needless to say, when he died, nobody in Israel mentioned a word about it, or very little. But during the Warsaw Ghetto, after that desperate resistance was crushed, the Germans went through the ghetto, burning down all the homes, all the houses, and Jews would jump out of the windows to their death, to escape the fires. And the Germans called them parachutists. Utter contempt for these human beings as they went to their death. Now, I've seen the same thing in Israel now. Not just the cruelty, everything you described, but the contempt. Have you seen that anywhere else? You've covered Sarajevo and the Bosnian horrors. You've covered Salvador and the death squads. You've covered the Middle East. What do you make of this incredible contempt? Have you thought about it?
You have to linguistically render people non-human before you kill them.
Yeah.
So this is why the current rhetoric around the Trump administration is so dangerous. It took 4 years of hate-filled speech before you got any Serbs to cross into Bosnia to begin the genocide.
Hmm.
And I think when you read the early history of the Nazis' rise to power, from 1933 to 1938 at least, Claudia Kunz writes about this, Hitler had to back off from going after the Jews, rhetorically. I mean, yeah. You had Kristallnacht, you had the brown shirts and the Nuremberg laws. That's why language is so key. Once you linguistically render people into, quote, gallants, to be human animals, and once people believe it, then it becomes, and we read about that in the death camps, Lipton's great book on Nazi doctors, they didn't look at them as human. And that was true in every war that I covered. And I would say the other thing is that you build this bizarre kind of a world view where evil is embodied in another.
Yeah.
And that when you eradicate the other, you've eradicated evil. That, of course, what it does is actually expand our own propensity for evil. And I think it's interesting, as you know, I graduated from divinity school, but I think in all of the great religious texts, there's including the Quran, when the prophet writes about jihad, he writes about three types of jihad, but the most important jihad is the battle to curb the evil within us. That's why I think Primo Levi is such an important writer.
Yeah.
Because and Levi argued over and over that that they were bastardizing or missing the true lesson of the Holocaust, in that we can all become Rumkowski, the Jewish collaborator who led the Lodz Ghetto.
Yeah.
But yes, language. Language is key. And you know, watching the way Trump and his minions use language to describe immigrants, to describe, you know, the radical leftists, we're moving very swiftly, and it's not a long step from the linguistic dehumanization to violence.
It's interesting you mentioned Trump, because a couple of days ago in Washington, D.C., I was there for an interview with Al Jazeera, and the person being interviewed right after me was Mary Trump, who's Donald Trump's niece. she's documented the incredible trauma in that family. But she writes something very interesting, which I think is very relevant to what you just said. In her book, The Reckoning, Mary Trump writes, and you gotta get, she comes from the same family. Same family. And she writes, we are a nation shackled by a cultural imperative to move from the pain of war, mass death, disease, and government-sanctioned barbarity in the name of peace or healing or a return to normal. When all we've really been doing is preserving the unchecked impunity of the powerful to inflict pain again, again, and again. This is Mary Trump.
I want to ask you about despair. I spent 7 years in and out of Gaza. And
yeah.
You were right, I think, in your speech to cite that sense of futility that we all feel,
yeah,
despite all of the energy many of us in this room put in to battling this genocide.
Yeah.
I know I find a kind of solace having been raised in a religious household, that it, you know, we're not finally judged by what we empirically achieve, but what we strive to achieve.
Yeah.
But despair is something you know a lot more about than I do. And I'm sure there's many like me in this room who struggle with it daily.
Well, I feel despair all the time. Not all the time, but frequently. So despair is a perfectly normal emotion. So is hatred, by the way. These are perfectly normal emotions in the face of what we're dealing with right now. But let me read you something that might put it into perspective. This is somebody writing a long time ago, but he might as well be writing about Gaza. He says, greed, hatred, and delusion of every kind are unwholesome. Whatever action a greedy, hating, and deluded person heaps up by deeds, words, or thoughts, that is unwholesome. Whatever such a person, overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, and his thoughts controlled by them, inflicts under false pretexts upon another by killing, imprisonment, confiscation of property, false accusations, or expulsion, that is all unwholesome. Who do you think is writing here? It's the Buddha.
Oh, wow.
2,500 years ago. And he's talking about expulsion, torture, confiscation of property, false accusation, killing, imprisonment. The Buddha, 2,500 years ago. Why am I saying this? Not to minimize in any way or to dismiss the importance of the present moment, but human beings have been dealing with this for a long time. And what is actually amazing and what is to be celebrated, this is my antidote to despair, such as it is. What is to be celebrated is that in the face of thousands of years of that kind of history, people still love the truth. People still love liberation. People still love freedom. People are still committed to justice. People are still outraged when they see these patterns arise and arise and over again. So that in addition to the despair, there's that real humanity that has never been extirpated and never will be. For what it's worth, that's my antidote to despair. This is a long-term story, and we can all make a contribution, and I think the response to despair, for God's sakes, do something, however little, however limited, but do it. Because it's the absence of agency, lack of activity, lack of engagement that really engenders despair.
Yeah. Well, all of these protests and these wonderful, courageous students who are our nation's conscience, who set up these encampments, to be honest, I would appear at the edge of the Columbia or Princeton. It was my therapy.
Yeah.
Really, quite literally. You know, I owe those students so much, and I admire them so much, and some of them are with us tonight.
Gideon Levy mentioned this recently, but I was aware of this for quite a while. A couple of years ago, 3 years ago, I went on a podcast with a Hollywood actor and comedian whose name is Mayim Bialik. And Mayim Bialik is one of the most fervent and ignorant and contemptuous supporters of Zionism you'll ever find. But that never came up in our interview, and I didn't know it about her at the time. Otherwise, frankly, I would not have gone on her program. We just talked about the stuff I usually talk about. Now, Mayim Bialik had a great, great, great grand uncle or grandfather called Chaim Nachman Bialik, who wrote a poem called The City of Slaughter. And The City of Slaughter was a poem that described these pogroms, these anti-Jewish massacres in the city of Kishinev in Russia, or in, I think in what's Ukraine now, in 1905. I'm going to read you the first two stanzas of Mayim Bialik, who's a great supporter of genocide. I'm going to read this poem by her distant antecedent in the Bialik family. It's called The City of Slaughter. And Gideon Levy recently printed this about Gaza. And here's the poem, the beginning of it. Rise and go now to the city of slaughter. Into its courtyard wind your way. There with thine own hands, touch with the eyes of thine hand and with the eyes of thy head. Behold on tree, on stone, on fence, on mural clay, the spattered blood and dyed brains of the dead. Proceed to the ruins, the split walls, reach where wider goes the hollow and greater goes the breach. Pass over the shattered earth and attain the broken wall, whose burnt and barren brick, whose charred stones reveal the open mouths of wounds that no mending shall ever mend and nor healing ever heal. Now, this is Bialik writing about Kishinev. My God, he's writing about Gaza. And his great, great granddaughter, whoever she is, cheers it on. That's the world that we're living in.
Let's first of all hear it for Chris and Dr. Matei. We would like to take some questions now from the audience. So if you have any questions, please feel free to line up.
I became a father in November, just after October 2023. Mm-hmm. Since then, I have seen dead children, starving children, mutilated families. Every day while I feed and dress my son, and I feel a lot of hatred. But I also, maybe because of some despair, I feel maybe delusional hope. I hope for the rise of the global south. I almost feel like it can't be any worse than what we're experiencing now. It can only be better. Do you feel that the world from a non-Western led order would be better?
Yes. The global south endured its own holocausts,
yeah,
which are not acknowledged by the perpetrators. The Herero, the Namaqua, the Armenians, the 1943 Bengal famine, in which 3 million Hindus died, and of course, Native Americans and African Americans have suffered holocausts. And Ami Cesari, in his book Discourse on Colonialism, said the reason the Holocaust resonated in the West is because it was done against white people. I do think that we are seeing the rise of the Global South assert itself. At the same time, if you haven't figured it out yet, all Trump and all his grifters and yahoos and Christian fascists are doing a pretty good job of imploding the American empire. They're going to take a lot of people down with them, but that's what they're doing. So yes, we are entering a world where the kind of hegemony of both Europe and the United States is no longer enforceable. And I don't know how, after this genocide, any figure from the UK, from Germany, from the United States is going to be able to stand up and talk about American virtue or the rule of law. I think we've been exposed for who we are.
Hi. I just returned from Gaza 2 weeks ago as a humanitarian worker, and just yesterday, the United Nations humanitarian country team put out the statement of rejecting the plan for Israeli military-administered aid. So my question is, what does morality and solidarity look like for these humanitarian organizations or institutions, and what then should regular people like us do who still want to help humans living in Gaza?
You know, I really wonder about that myself, because like even an organization like Middle East Children's Alliance, for whom this benefit is being held tonight, if the Israelis really decide that they're going to be the spigot that's either open or closed for humanitarian aid, food, medicine, to get into Gaza, how's anybody going to force it through when the rest of the world allows them to maintain that control? So I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that. When we donate money, I mean, I'm not trying just to discourage anybody, on the contrary, but in this world that we're heading into, how we can even ensure that the pittance that we can put together would even get through? Do you have any answer to that, Chris?
Clearly, they want to use aid as a weapon.
Yeah.
Basically, what the Israelis are attempting to do. The militarization of aid is not an Israeli invention, by the way. USAID, let's not sugarcoat what that was very much weaponized in the interests of large corporations and the American empire. But this is just a disastrous move, because it will just become another weapon in Israel's arsenal to manipulate, and I fear, push the Palestinians probably into the northern Sinai.
I think we can just keep pushing and talking and advocating and donating and have some trust that they can't do everything that they want to do. We have to be wise to their tricks. Mm. Now for years, this is before October the 7th, whenever the New York Times mentioned Hamas, it would de rigueur add, Hamas is an organization that denies the right of Israel to exist. Now, first of all, that wasn't even quite true. But even insofar as it was, when they mentioned the Likud, in whose constitution it's forbidden to think about a non-Jewish state between the river and the sea, they would never say Likud is an organization who denies the right of the Palestinian state to exist. But we just take it for granted. Even now, when they report the number of Palestinian dead, they say, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Ministry of Health, they never say, according to the Trump-run American Ministry of Health or the Likud-run Israeli Ministry of Health. These little tricks that get under our skin without even us noticing it. That's the first point. Second point is, I read the biography or the memoirs of Albert Speer. Speer was an interesting character. He was the Hitler's architect and friend, and also his economic minister. And he spent 20 years in Spandau jail as a war criminal after the Nuremberg trials. And Speer, whether genuinely or disingenuously, but he writes the following. He said, everybody's asking, what did you know? What did you know? But he said, that's the wrong question. He said, the right question is not what did you know, but what you could have known if you wanted to. And he describes two incidents when once he was in one of these factories of Krupp or Tyson, one of these German mega corporations who still exist, where they use slave laborers. And he ran into some of these slave laborers and he asked them, would you rather be here or in the camps? And they looked at them with absolute horror. And Speer said, I never asked them why. And he describes another incident where some German Wehrmacht general is talking to Speer, and Speer says, I'd like to go see what's happening in the East sometime. And the general said, whatever you do, don't go to the East. And Speer said, I never asked why. But the difference is that there was no alternative media. There was no YouTube, TikTok, there was no Chris Hedges, there was no Glenn Greenwald, there was no Matt Taibbi, there was no Aaron Mate, there was no Amy Goodman. There was just the mainstream media. Now there are, at least for now, all these alternative sources. People have a lot less excuse not to know now than they ever did in Nazi Germany. And sometimes I do say to people, there's no pain-free option.
Right.
It's a question of which pain would you rather have? The pain of self-suppression, self-betrayal, or the pain of disapproval or sanctions against you? That's your choice, but there's no pain-free option necessarily.
Please join me in thanking our two speakers.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Gabor Mate and Chris Hedges on Palestine, the moral issue of our time. They spoke at the Society of Ethical Culture in New York in May 2025. Chris Hedges is an award-winning independent journalist. He's the author of many books. His latest is A Genocide Foretold. Gabor Mate, a Holocaust survivor, is a Hungarian-born Canadian physician with a special interest in childhood development and trauma. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Gabor Mate and Chris Hedges on Palestine, the Moral Issue of Our Time, and for Chris Hedges' book, A Genocide Foretold, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon.
And welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Our guest today is Jaime Martinez, the community defense organizer at Casa San Jose. First question, Jaime, is what is Casa San Jose?
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be speaking to folks on the radio. Casa San Jose is a resource center for the Latino community here in southwestern Pennsylvania. We were actually founded in 2013 by a sister of St. Joseph, Sister Janice Vanderneck. It began with her seeing that a community was under-resourced and there was no real space in the community to be addressing those needs. So she said, yes, I want to do something, and started finding solutions. Put her ear to the ground with two other people in the basement of a Lutheran church and figuring out what folks need and delivering solutions. Since then, 12 years later, we have expanded to over 35 employees. We have social workers. We have an organizing and advocacy program. And we have really established ourselves as the go-to source of support for underserved Latinos in the community.
You now serve, I think, around 6,000 people a year?
Yeah, that's right.
And what kinds of things do you do for them?
So that's anything from, I need help with groceries, I don't know how I'm going to make rent, to I need to get my child a passport. All of those kinds of services we are really good with. We have also been good with connecting folks to legal services, helping them to develop sustainable solutions to any financial issues they may have and working through that with them. And beyond that, in the time that we find ourselves in now, we are working on community defense, which is kind of where I come in, right? We've seen the news. We've seen how the Latino community and the immigrant community at large is being scapegoated, is being demoralized, and we are at the forefront of making sure that folks' rights are protected, that we are engaging and organizing the community in a way that celebrates and includes our immigrant community, and trying to build power.
So I know Casa San Jose runs Know Your Rights sessions for immigrants to the United States.
So Know Your Rights sessions are what happens if you have an interaction with law enforcement? What happens if immigration enforcement shows up at your house, at your workplace, or stops you in your car, or stops you in public? What can you expect? What do they look like? How can you respond? These are the kinds of sessions that we've been having all across Southwest PA over the past 4 months, basically. We've had over 50 sessions since the beginning of the year, and we've served more than 800 people.
So if ICE comes knocking on somebody's door, what should they do?
A few things on that. At large, I think a common refrain that I use that folks should internalize is that ICE preys on the ignorant and the isolated. Folks that are walking alone, that are walking to work alone, that live alone, or that drive alone, that don't have support networks in the community, that are isolated from their community. That's a prime target for ICE, because they know that if they grab that person, if they abduct that person, because that's what's happening, no one will know that they're gone. And that's better for them, because it'll grind down the person's humanity and make them more likely to sign deportation papers once they're in detention. ICE will prey on ignorant folks, folks that don't know their rights. They will show up in packs. They will always outnumber the people that they are looking for. We've seen an average of like 4 to 7 agents showing up to an interaction looking for one person, and that's for one person. We have seen as many as 17 agents showing up to a single family home, all of them armed, one of them with an AR-15. So they will look to be aggressive, provoke, intimidate, manipulate, and they will try to get into your house. So it's really important, going back to your question, is you should never open the door. You should ask them through the door to identify themselves. That's full name, badge number, what agency they're with, why they're there. And then if they want to get in, if they want to talk to you, they need a judicial warrant. Tell them, I need to see a signed warrant by a judge. If they don't have that, you should not open that door and implicitly give them access into your home. If they do make it into your home, if you do open the door for some reason, very important that you speak the words, I do not consent to this. I do not consent to this search. I do not consent to you being in my home right now. That's a key legal phrase that kind of harkens back to the Fourth Amendment, the right to refuse unreasonable searches or seizures. Exactly. Right. That's right. So you got to tell folks, I do not consent, and that Fourth Amendment protection is strongest in the home, and you should not let them in without a warrant signed by a judge.
Sounds like people from other countries legally do have rights in the United States.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just had a great conversation with a lawyer from the ACLU about this yesterday out in Philadelphia. When it comes to things like the First Amendment, we were talking more about the context of people protesting and their rights with the First Amendment. It's not completely settled as to whether non-citizens have like the full breadth of First Amendment rights. Many courts have established that that is the case, that if you are here in the U.S., if you are on American soil, you have access to those constitutional rights, and those are very broad. But President Trump has appointed many judges that may have different opinions, and these cases haven't been tested too much. So we might see a new flurry of cases coming to a different set of judges in this era that might give us different responses. But broadly speaking, we should act as if, yes, we do have those protections and hope for the best.
Sounds like what you're saying is prior to 2025, case law had established the precedent that foreign nationals in this country legally were also protected by the United States Constitution, but now...
had incredible bipartisan support because we flexed our muscles and set those demands and made them have to agree with